ice people, they're just made of ice. They don't treat their fellow man very nice. You wear your hair long as Jesus did. They'll crucify you. You're not part of the establishment. You stand up for your rights. They'll call you a fool. If you don't go to war, you're not living by the golden rule. Ice people, they're just made of ice. They don't treat the fellow man very nice. The reservation, and the black man just lives anywhere he can, and the poor white man, he doesn't live any better. He can't say, I'm red, I'm black, I'm yellow.
Self-titled album, I think 1971 that came out. Prior to that, Molly O'Bomzawin. The track was called Wawastanita off of her 2022 release, Sweet Tooth. NRBQ off of their self-titled 1969 release. Before that, I Didn't Know Myself. Improvisation 3 from the archive series of Sam Rivers that was released in 2023, and All You Fascists Bound to Lose by Woody Guthrie opened up that little segment. Thanks for tuning in, folks. This has been an experiment with time on WRCT. This show airs every Saturday night at midnight. Check out the full playlist up on WRCT.org if you've been digging the music you've been listening to. And that's about it. Take care of yourselves. We'll see you here next week.
solidão me dá. Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, there is obviously much to process about the election and much to think and strategize about how to make resistance more impactful and more supportive of the people who are at the sharpest end of what a Trump administration says it intends. One of many things we're seeing is the value of a focus on policy making, on change making at the local and state level, often sidelined in media coverage of presidential elections. One issue worth keeping an eye on, not just for what it is, but for how we got here, legalized sports betting. Passed by a whisker in Missouri on November 5th, legal sports gambling is the apple of the eye of many corporate and private state actors. But how does it affect states and communities and people? Our guest wrote in depth on that question ahead of the election. Journalist Amos Barshad is senior enterprise reporter for The Lever and author of the book No One Man Should Have All That Power: How Rasputins Manipulate the World, from Abrams Press. We'll hear from him on today's show. That's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at some recent press. On November 4th, the New York Times was describing Donald Trump as a threat to democracy. A couple of weeks later, the paper's Peter Baker describes the scary clown car of Trump's cabinet nominees, firebrand allies with unconventional resumes, in a piece headlined, Trump Takes on Pillars of Deep State. So that's where we're at. Corporate news media paddling furiously to normalize the appointments of a rapist, racist grifter, while out of the other side of their mouths, they hope we hear their sad violins about democracy. Examples abound, but FAIR's Julie Holler looked at NPR and found no evidence they intend to use the power of the press to shore up the limits around democratic institutions that Trump has wasted no time in pushing. In its reporting on Trump's picks over the past week, NPR's Morning Edition has featured 8 guest sources offering commentary, either in soundbites or lengthier interviews. All but 2 were current or former Republican officials, including one current Trump advisor. The other 2 were a representative from the right-wing Center for Strategic and International Studies and a political risk consultant who offered a neutral assessment. All of them were white men. The most forceful denunciations of Trump's parade of shockingly unqualified nominees that Morning Edition listeners were permitted, therefore, came from John Bolton, one of the most right-wing members of the George W. Bush administration. And the show made sure to balance that interview by giving one later in the week to Trump advisor Mark Lauder. The dearth of nonpartisan experts, the utter absence of any progressive or even liberal voices, meant that only Trump's most outrageous picks thus far, Matt Gaetz, who has since withdrawn, Pete Hegseth, Tulsi Gabbard, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., they were the only ones subject to expert criticism on the show. Meanwhile, most of his other picks weren't even mentioned, let alone scrutinized. In a sane democracy, the news media would be taking a close look at those candidates, too. But just one guest, a former George W. Bush official, made the only mention of Mike Huckabee, Elise Stefanik, and Mike Waltz as picks. And he called them leaders who have to be taken seriously. Huckabee, listeners may know, picked as ambassador to Israel, has argued repeatedly that the West Bank is Israeli territory and that, quote, there's no such thing as a Palestinian, close quote. Waltz, for National Security Advisor, wants Israel to bomb Iranian nuclear sites. And Stefanik, tapped to be UN ambassador, led the congressional witch hunt against college presidents last spring. It wasn't just Morning Edition sane-washing Trump's picks at NPR. In a piece about the selection of RFK Jr. to head the Department of Health and Human Services, NPR's headline and opening framed the anti-science conspiracy theorist as just a guy who, quote, wants to make America healthy again, close quote, but who, quote, could face a lot of pushback, close quote. It took seven paragraphs for reporters Will Stone and Allison Aubrey to mention that scientists are, quote, deeply worried about Kennedy's history of questioning scientific consensus on vaccines and his antagonism to mainstream medicine more broadly, close quote. After quoting one public health expert who expressed strong fears about the serious damage Kennedy could do to the country's public health system, NPR cheerfully offered the other side of things. Quote, and yet there's no denying there are areas of substantial overlap between the goals of MAHA, that's Make America Healthy Again, and scientists who have long advocated for tackling the root causes of chronic illness, close quote. The reporters pointed out some contradictions between Kennedy's regulatory goals, he says he's going to take on big food and big pharma, and the GOP-Trump war on government regulation of big corporations. But they gave the last word, unrebutted, to a Kennedy advisor who says, quote, I would tell anyone skeptical about this to look at the positives here, he says. This MAHA agenda is one of the golden areas for true bipartisan reform. He says Kennedy's approach will be to insist on what he terms accurate science, close quote. In total, Julie Holler found the piece gave more time to Kennedy allies with products to sell than to actual public health experts. On Trump's nominee for energy secretary, oil executive Chris Wright, NPR offered a textbook example of sane washing that ought to have jarred any editor. Quote, Wright has also expressed doubts about whether climate change is driving extreme weather events. There is no climate crisis, and we're not in the midst of an energy transition either, Wright said in a video uploaded to LinkedIn. We have seen no increase in the frequency or intensity of hurricanes, tornadoes, droughts, or floods, despite endless fear-mongering of the media, politicians, and activists, he also said in the video. The only thing resembling a crisis with respect to climate change is the regressive, opportunity-squelching policies justified in the name of climate change, close quote. Well, those quotes don't illustrate doubts about whether climate change is driving extreme weather events. They illustrate anti-science climate denialism in the form of flat-out lies. As Fair reported recently, NPR installed a backstop editorial team last month to review all content prior to airing or publishing after the latest round of right-wing complaints of bias. When the Corporation for Public Broadcasting announced it would be funding that backstop team, it explained the purpose was to help NPR achieve the, quote, highest standards of editorial integrity, including accuracy, fairness, balance, objectivity, and transparency, and the obligation to include diverse viewpoints, close quote. So there were a couple of exceptions, but in the main, the incredibly lopsided balance, the lack of actually diverse viewpoints, the dubious fairness or accuracy displayed in the network's nomination coverage makes pretty clear what the CPB was really going for with that new oversight it installed. An example of the approved reporting, NPR senior political editor Domenico Montanaro told listeners of All Things Considered the difference between Trump's 2016 picks and those this year, saying the 2016 nominations, quote, sometimes stood in the way of things he wanted to do that broke with the normal way that things had been done for years. This time around, he's really surrounding himself with a team of loyalists, close quote. Well, what former cabinet members did was stop Trump from doing things that were unconstitutional or frank abuses of power. For NPR to gesture toward that as the way things had been done for years indicates that the network is more concerned with preserving its CPB funding than sustaining democracy. Finally, a no comment, because what can we even say? CNN's Dana Bash interviewed Democratic Ohio Congressmember Greg Landsman on November 18th about a neo-Nazi march in Columbus, in which footage showed at least one marcher repeatedly shouting the N-word. Quote, a group of neo-Nazis paraded through that city, wearing, waving swastikas. We don't know what side of the aisle this comes from, close quote. Bash did allow that, typically neo-Nazis are from the far right. So if that doesn't strike you as razor-sharp good faith analysis, you might be outgrowing so-called liberal elite news media. Among other happenings on November 5th, Missouri narrowly passed a ballot measure that will legalize sports gambling in the state. Like similar measures in other states, Amendment 2 came with a lot of promises and perhaps not deep enough questions, as our guest explored in a timely report. Journalist Amos Barshad is senior enterprise reporter for The Lever, online at levernews.com, and author of the book, No One Man Should Have All That Power, How Rasputins Manipulate the World, from Abrams Press. He joins us now by phone from here in New York City. Welcome to Counterspin, Amos Barshad.
Thank you so much for having me.
So ballot measure sounds very bottom up, but Amendment 2 did not arise, as it were, organically from the community. Who did you find to be the driving forces behind it?
Yeah, we found that backers of the ballot measure were the two big sports gambling companies, FanDuel and DraftKings, which are national corporations that probably a lot of people are familiar with through their advertising. And they allied with the professional sports team in Missouri. There's six of them. And everyone kind of got together to push forward this ballot measure. I don't know what the final number was. At least something like $36 million was spent backing this ballot measure.
Well, and we should take a minute to note that there's a relevant Supreme Court ruling from 2018 that kind of opened the floodgates to states doing this legalizing of sports gambling, right? There was a law on the books and it got taken off.
That's right. Yeah. So 2018 Supreme Court decision opened the door for states to make their own decisions on sports gambling. And very quickly, many states legalized. So we are up to 38 as of this year before November, and then Missouri did become the 39th state.
Now, there's a sort of a blueprint that the industry uses, and it seems to be working, but there's kind of a template that's gone from one state to another, right? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so what we found through our reporting is that the industry often makes promises that the tax revenue from sports gambling will go to causes that most people could get behind. So in Missouri specifically, it was education in the public school system, money for teachers, money for kids in the public school system. And that's common. I think a lot of people would maybe know that a lot of state lotteries allocate money for education.
Right.
From there, we kind of found that it gets a little bit more cynical for two reasons. Specifically in Missouri, the critics, the group that was opposing this ballot measure, made a compelling argument that there isn't that much guaranteed money going to education, that the way that the rule was written both creates carve-outs for the gambling companies to actually not pay quite as much in taxes as it might seem. Plus, then from there, there's not even a direct conduit created, so the money will go to education. Yeah, that's kind of been the, like you said, like the blueprint. So we looked at other states, and it seems like, for example, in Colorado, which faces drought, you know, climate change, the money was earmarked to address water scarcity. Washington, D.C., parents face really high family expenses, so the promises was funding for childcare. And it's almost like they're engineering the end result. They're saying, we can fix your problem. And in California, which voted down the legalized sports gambling ballot measure in 2022, the money would have gone to try to alleviate the homelessness crisis. But basically, the groups opposing that were able to effectively communicate that the industry makes these promises that they can't keep. They're telling you that this will solve your issues, but it's not true.
Well, and I wanted to ask you a little more about what we do know about that track record, but I just wanted to point out that in this piece in the Kansas City Star from November 6th, it says, a fiscal note attached to the measure estimated that the state revenue generated from legalized sports betting would range from nothing to $28.9 million each year.
Right.
But the campaign argued those figures would be much higher. Well, yeah, higher than nothing would be great. But I mean, this is even in the measure itself, it doesn't sound like a promise.
Yeah, exactly. And it's really interesting because whatever any given voter's personal opinion on sports gambling is, you can then go from, okay, but we should write the legislation to ensure that the promises that are being made are being kept. And basically, part of the reason why that minimum could be zero is because of this carve-out that the industry has successfully pushed for in state after state, which is that they can use their promotional spending against their tax bill, basically, which means the money that they use to kind of lure in new gamblers. And it's a whole big conversation about issues with sports gambling where that, again, gets pretty cynical. And that's money basically spent on luring in, you could say, problem gamblers, people with gambling addiction issues. So they're using that money that's spent trying to hook new gamblers, and that not only maybe exacerbates the situation for any given person gambling too much that can go into debt, create personal problems in their life, but then they get to deduct that from their tax bill. So,
So we have at least 38 sort of case studies, and it sounds as though you've said it, but can we say that there's not a strong track record here in terms of sports betting filling budget holes in any meaningful way?
It's an interesting question because, again, you can go state by state. So in the state of New York, they were able to push for a 51% tax rate, which, as it sounds, extremely high. That's the highest in the nation. There's a few other states that have it at that rate as well. And they have been able to collect significant funds for, and the New York state, it goes to education as well. But it's interesting, even there, there's kind of legislators that are friendly to the industry that have tried to claw back, lower that tax rate, actually have tried to introduce that same carve-out where the gambling companies get to use the promotional spending to deduct from the tax bill. And then in the other state, it can be 10%. I think that's the tax rate in Missouri. A lot of the other states are set at 10%. And yeah, it doesn't become a significant enough source of funding to ameliorate all the issues that are then caused from legalized sports gambling. And I think the other point on that is education costs go up. These big issues, the costs go up year after year, but is the revenue from the gambling going up year after year? Like, it seems that that's not necessarily the case.
You have a fact in the piece that says in the run-up to the 2023 Super Bowl, Kansans bet $194 million, from which the state of Kansas raked in $1,134. Yeah. That is not impressive.
It's a stark figure, and that's all about that carve-out that I mentioned. All that money, a lot of it was promotional money, quote-unquote free bets. What actually happens is they get you onto their app. Once you're on there, it says, oh, you have to spend this $5 by a certain time. So they have a very good track record. These gambling companies that are extremely good at getting people onto the apps and getting them to spend more than they necessarily intended to. And you hear, here's a free $5 bet, but from there, no, you have to spend a certain amount of money within a certain amount of time to cash in on the offers. So as you can see, for a particularly egregious example, but you're talking about a ton of money being spent, and the end result is not what would seem to be the correct amount of correlating tax revenue for the state.
Well, the piece starts with a photo op in which the mascots from Missouri's professional sports teams delivered boxes of signatures in support of Amendment 2 to the Secretary of State's office. Very cute. What is in it for the teams? What do the teams see that made them put millions and millions of dollars into this?
Historically, the professional sports teams in America were against legalized sports gambling for probably reasons you'd expect, feeling that it would corrupt the sport in ways. We're probably all familiar with certain scandals over the history of like American professional sports in the 20th century, most famously Pete Rose, a baseball player, the idea that maybe once you legalize, you incentivize more gambling, that players would have a reason to throw games or affect what's happening on the field because of gambling interests. But basically, once the 2018 Supreme Court decision came out, once they saw just how much money was there to make, sports teams in America did a complete 180 and are all behind this. And they're not directly collecting money. There's not like anything written into the law where they get a certain percentage of the amount that's gambled. But what ends up happening is that these sports gambling companies, they have so much money to spend, and they end up spending it through the sports team. They might set up a by advertising inside the stadium or during the broadcast of the team's games. They might even set up like booths inside the stadium, so they have to pay teams for the right to do that. These teams know that if gambling is legalized in their state, that their marketing revenue is going to go up a certain amount.
Well, another interesting part of this very interesting piece is FanDuel, their parent company called Flutter. They operate in the UK. That's where they started. But they have different rules about just the kinds of things that you've been talking about over there, don't they?
Yeah, and I think that's really an important part of everything because, again, any given person might think about sports gambling and the legalization of it and say, it does exist in other states or another country. Is it really so bad? And I think that the counter argument would really be, look at the regulation that is happening in other countries, specifically in the UK. It's actually been about 20 years since this kind of online mobile betting took off. And what critics say is that what took decades of families being ruined, individual lives being ruined through gambling debts, for really good regulation to come in, which gambling companies are legally obligated to make sure that the people betting aren't betting beyond their means and that they aren't exhibiting problem gambling behaviors. And in the U.S., because this is relatively new, that regulation just doesn't exist. So you could say, okay, I believe in legalized sports gambling. I want the tax revenue to come in. But from there, you have to think, what is the impact on people? What is actually going to happen next? And you can see where sports gambling is legal, there is a spike in addiction and issues of that nature. And so the question is, are we just going to let companies kind of write the rule book? Mm-hmm. Or is there common sense regulation that could come in that would really save a lot of people?
Well, and I do see in the write-ups from Missouri and other states, there's kind of an offhand reference to, oh, yes, some of the revenue has to go to this fund to combat problem gambling or something. But it is very vague.
Yeah, so it's basically anytime a state legalizes sports gambling, they'll also either indicate that a certain amount of money is going to go to a pre-existing state problem gambling fund or create a whole new one. So it's very much, we are aware that these issues are going to come in and we're going to try to tackle them. What I tried to point out in the piece is that there isn't some sense that we're going to prevent people from becoming addicts in the first place. We're just going to be there to treat them after they become addicts. And I think we can see the obvious issue there to accept the fact that harm is going to happen on a large public scale and then say, and then we'll deal with it, is not ever going to be as effective as trying to make sure that that harm doesn't take place in the first place.
There is, as you've been discussing, a real incentive system to keep people betting. But right now, this is still betting on actual games that actually happen, but some folks see a slippery slope. Talk about iGaming.
iGaming is the industry preferred term for any kind of casino game that we might be familiar with, probably most famously slots, and you can just basically play a digital version of that on your phone. But it just creates an endless variety of options for people to gamble on. It's legal in some states, and the push is to continue legalizing it, and it's basically much more lucrative because people lose more money playing it. And the way that it's set up, the way that certain games are created, for example, you could play multiple hands of blackjack. There's one infamous game that you're basically betting on, watching a little cartoon rocket go up, and you're trying to guess when the rocket will explode. So it's almost cutesy children's entertainment almost, but people on spending real money and losing real money playing these games. Again, it goes back to the idea of regulation. What are we going to allow people to bet on as far as knowing that if they get hooked on these games that it could damage their lives? I think with the iGaming, the way that some critics of the industry have talked about it is that this sports gambling wave was always the prelude to this next phase, this iGaming phase. And when you think about it that way, yeah, it can feel a bit alarming that there isn't any kind of organized pushback on a national level, because I think that's what we're talking about. As we mentioned, this has passed in Missouri, and looking at the last few states left in the country, there's good reason to think that they'll get up to or close to having sports gambling be legal in every state in the country. You just have to wait and see. But I think the question is, from there, then that obviously would maybe indicate the need for a national response. And there are Representative Paul Tonko, a congressman from the state of New York. He has introduced a bill called the Safe Bet Act, and it's kind of the first attempt to create restrictions, to create protection, to push back on gambling companies who are currently have a complete green light to do what they want.
Finally, it was a very tight race. Amendment 2 passed by something like half a percentage point in Missouri, and we should understand that in the context that there were all these major sports teams and millions of dollars supporting it. So there are a lot of people, it seems, who are concerned about this, who are pushing back on this. And there's a constituency there to stay in conversation with, it seems. And I just wonder what you would like to see along with the regulation from the state and perhaps from the federal level, what would you like to see in terms of reporting, follow-up reporting on this incredibly impactful and interesting issue?
As we talked about, all this has only been legal since 2018, so the data that has come in since then is starting to indicate the exact severity of the problem, and I think we're just only going to see more of that. We're going to have more hard numbers on what this is actually doing to people. There has been and continues to be great reporting on this, and yeah, definitely would just love to see more of that, because we can really quantify this and say, okay, sports gambling would come in, here's the amount of tax revenue that is created, and here's the corresponding issues that it's led to. And I think if you look at it in that way, it's really black and white, and people can make informed decisions on where they stand on it, rather than, like we spoke about, being swayed by the funny mascots running around pushing their beloved sports teams pushing it, or being told that money is going to go to education. You can kind of divorce yourself from the sales pitch and say, okay, what's the reality? The numbers are all going to be there.
All right, then. We've been speaking with Amos Barshad. You can find the article, The Gambling Industry's Cynical Play for Your Vote, at levernews.com. Thank you so much, Amos Barshad, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of the show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find all of that on our website, fair.org. And the site is also the place to show very much needed support for this show and for FAIR, if you are able and so inclined. The show is engineered by Riley Baer. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
전화 도돼 알고 싶어져 알고 싶어져 너의 모든 게다 사소하더라도 사소하더라도 알려줘 네 모든 걸 Action 오늘 네 옆자리 나 널 웃게 해줄 사람 나 기분이 갖추어 나 모든 게 난 궁금해
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, corporate news media continue to report things like Israel's recent strike on the Gaza Strip that killed at least 19 people in an area designated a refuge for Palestinians. And they continue to include warnings of a possible wider war in the region. But there's little sense of urgency of something horrible happening that U.S. citizens could have a role in preventing. We'll talk about that with media critic, activist, and teacher Gregory Shupak. Also on the show, U.S. media have a similar another day, another tragedy outlook on gun violence. It happens, we're told, but all reporters need to do is quote people saying it's bad, yet oddly unavoidable, and they're done. We'll hear from Robert Spitzer, a historian of gun regulation and gun rights, about some spurious reasons behind the impasse on gun violence. That studied lack of urgent concern about human life, is that journalism? Why do the press corps need a constitutional amendment to protect their ability to speak if all they're going to say is, oh, well? That's coming up this week on Counterspin. The September 11th New York Times reports a fatal Israeli airstrike hitting part of the Gaza Strip that Israel had declared a humanitarian zone. On a separate matter, we read that Secretary of State Anthony Blinken rebuked Israel for the killing in the West Bank of 26-year-old U.S. human rights activist Ashnor Ege. While it relayed terrible news, the Times story also contained the mealy-mouthing we're accustomed to. Blinken rebuked Israel's killing Ashnor Ege, quote, after the Israeli military acknowledged that one of its soldiers had probably killed her unintentionally, close quote. People did dig with their bare hands through bomb craters in the dark to search for victims, but, quote, health officials in Gaza do not distinguish between civilians and combatants when reporting casualties, close quote. And while it notes that the UN and other rights organizations have said there is no safe place in Gaza, the Times repeats that, quote, Israel insists that it will go after militants wherever it believes them to be, close quote. What's happening in Gaza and the West Bank is horrific. The possibility of an expanded war in the Middle East is terrifying. But for elite U.S. news media, it's as though war in the Middle East and Palestinians being killed is such a comfortable story that there's no urgency in preventing the reality. Joining us now to talk about this is media critic, activist, and teacher Gregory Shupak. He teaches English and media studies at the University of Guelph Humber in Toronto, and he's author of the book The Wrong Story, Palestine, Israel, and the Media from OR Books. He joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Gregory Shupak.
Hi, how are you?
So the New York Times, September 10th, had a story about how health workers are trying to vaccinate children in northern Gaza against polio, but supplies of fuel and medicine are being obstructed by Israeli forces, including one convoy of UN groups that was held at gunpoint for 8 hours. So the meat of the Time story is here. Quote, the Israeli military said in a statement that it had intelligence suggesting that there were Palestinian suspects with the convoy, but did not say what they were suspected of doing. In another statement on Tuesday, it said that Israeli security forces questioned the suspects in the field and then released them. The episode highlighted the challenges facing humanitarian efforts like the vaccination campaign and what UN officials say is increasing Israeli obstruction of aid deliveries to Gaza, close quote. So Israel holds up a humanitarian group at gunpoint for 8 hours, and they don't offer anything resembling a reason. And the upshot is this highlights challenges. UN officials say that this is an obstruction of aid. Knowing reporters, we know that some of them are saying, look how we pushed back against Israel here. We said they couldn't say what the suspects were suspected of. But it doesn't read as brave challenging of the powerful to a reader. And of course, we know that that language is a choice, right? So what are you making of media coverage right now?
Two main observations come to mind, not specifically with regard to the story you're talking about, although that does continue, as you said, the longer term trends of this kind of mealy mouth refusal to just report what has flatly and plainly and obviously happened and who's responsible for it. But setting that aside, I would note a couple of other things that have troubled me. One is that I think so much of the Palestinian issue right now has just been kind of metabolized into U.S. election coverage, so that
right,
most of what the public is getting on the issue is how is the political theater going to be affected by the fact that a genocide is occurring in which the U.S. is a direct participant, rather than more urgent questions such as how can this genocide be immediately stopped? So I think that that's a real case of focusing on the wrong question. I think likewise that you get some attention to, well, how, you know, is the Harris campaign going to suffer because the Biden administration, of which she's a part, has alienated so many Arab and or Muslim voters in the United States because of the Gaza genocide. Again, that just kind of reduces the Palestinians and their supporters amongst Arabs and Muslims, not to say nothing of many other segments of American society that do support Palestinians to one extent or another. They're just here reduced to kind of, well, how's this going to factor into the electoral calculation?
Right.
And so that, I think, is, again, really not at all adequate to the challenge of responding to one of the worst series of massacres that we've seen since World War II. In fact, the UN Special Rapporteur on Food just the other day said that this is the worst campaign of deliberate starvation since World War II. So just treating this as like a subset of U.S. domestic politics is not proportional to the severity of what's unfolding. The second observation I'm going to make is that I think to a really, really depressing extent, the mass murder of Palestinians, the mass starvation of Palestinians, the total destruction of essentially every structure in Gaza by this point, it's becoming kind of a dog bites man story, in that it's just become, and I hate to use the word normalized because I think it's totally overused these days, but this is sort of a case study where it's barely even newsworthy that really just shocking atrocity dropping day by day. So, I mean, last week, Israel bombed a shelter within the compound of the Al-Aqsa Hospital, I believe it's Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir al-Bala. And this has, as far as I can tell, effectively zero coverage in major English language, American or Western media broadly. But again, right, that is a real travesty to
just allow this to not be a leading story every day because it keeps happening. In fact, the fact that it keeps happening ought to be in itself proof of how dire and urgent these matters are.
You wrote for Electronic Intifada back in July about how even after credible source after credible source confirms that Israel is carrying out a genocide against Palestinians, you said we find ourselves living through a mass public genocide denial. And without at all trying to be coy, I wonder, are we now at acceptance?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now it's just kind of a factor. And I wrote down Dog Bites Man because it very much gives that feeling of, oh, well, these folks are at war with one another. That's just kind of a normal story.
Yeah. And first of all, genocide can and should never be just a normal story.
No.
But that is very much what it's being treated like. And second of all, it's also not, right? I mean, it's kind of like, yes, brutal, violent oppression of Palestinians has been the case since Israel came into existence in 1948. And in fact, in the years leading up to it, there were certainly steps taken to create the conditions for Israel. So it is a decades-old story, but there is a kind of hand-waving that creeps into public discourse and I think does underlie some of this lack of attention to what continues to happen in Gaza and the West Bank. In reality, this is a very modern conflict, right? It's a U.S.-brokered settler colonial insurgency counterinsurgency. It's got very little to do with religion and everything to do with geopolitics and capitalism and colonialism. But it's easier to just sort of treat it as, oh, well, these backward, savage barbarians and their ancient, inscrutable blood feuds are just doing what they have always done and always will. So that's not worthy of our attention. But that, aside from being wildly inaccurate, just enables the slaughter and dispossession, as well as resistance to it, to continue.
Finally, to promote the idea or to support the idea that this genocide is kind of okay or par for the course anyway, and that protesting it is misguided or worse,
mm-hmm.
that requires mental gymnastics, including charges of anti-Semitism against Jewish people.
Yeah.
Jewish people are leaders in the opposition to Israel's actions, including on college campuses. And I would encourage folks to read Carrie Zaremba's piece on Mondo Weiss about the lengths that university administrators are going to right now mm-hmm. to crack down on and impossibilize dissent and political expression. But the point is, we still see the dissent. So even the problems that we're talking about, that media are sort of ratifying and pushing out day after day, people are seeing through them, and there is dissent. And I just wonder what your thoughts are in terms of, maybe not to use the word hope, but where do you see the resistance happening? You're a college professor.
Certainly on campuses and many other places as well. Labor organization, there was a coalition here called Labor for Palestine, and I know there are similar, you know, outfits in the United States and other parts of the world. Religious organizations of all sorts, Christian, Muslim, Jewish, likely others as well. I would, in addition, say that certainly in terms of just getting out analysis and information, then one of the very few kind of advantages or bright spots that we have, I think, now as compared to the past, is that it is easier for independent sources like FAIR, Electronic Intifada, Mondo Weiss, and others to circulate quickly to wide audiences. And that, I think, has been a big reason why the Palestinian counter-narrative has been able to puncture, I think, the public consciousness more so than it could in the past. I think it's totally the independent educational efforts by the Palestinian Solidarity Movement that has done that. And one major tool at their, or perhaps I will dare say our, disposal is independent media, because this is where you're getting much more information, much more accurate information, and much more rigorous analysis than the sort of fluff and pablum that you get on the editorial pages of the New York Times or Washington Post, much less the blood-curdling racism you get on the Wall Street Journal and its editorial pages. So I think that this era does have one serious advantage, and that's that outlets like those that I've mentioned have a much greater capacity to reach people who might not otherwise be exposed to this anti-Zionist narrative.
We've been speaking with Gregory Shupak. He teaches English and Media Studies at the University of Guelph Humber. And his book, The Wrong Story, Palestine, Israel, and the Media, is still out now from OR Books. Greg Shupak, thanks so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
Our guest began a piece for Time magazine, quote, "Soon after these fearsome weapons began to circulate in society, they developed a notorious reputation. Developed for the battlefield, these guns in civilian hands became the tools of choice in gruesome, highly publicized shootings. Calls for their restriction or banishment escalated, and state legislatures moved to enact new laws." Close quote. The kicker is that he's talking about the 1920s and the Tommy gun, the Thompson machine gun. Today's opponents of efforts to quell gun violence with regulation often hand wave toward U.S. history, the Founding Fathers, the Second Amendment, to bolster their case. And that can be persuasive if it's unchecked. Checking it is what Robert Spitzer does. He's adjunct professor at College of William and Mary School of Law and professor emeritus of political science at SUNY Cortland. He's the author of numerous books, including most recently The Gun Dilemma from Oxford University Press. He joins us now by phone from Williamsburg, Virginia. Welcome to Counterspin, Robert Spitzer.
Good to speak with you.
Dispelling myths about the history of guns is important at any time, but it's crucial right now as the Supreme Court has explicitly inserted historicity into our ability to make decisions about the place guns have in society. Can I ask you to explain the 2022 Bruin decision and your reaction to it? What should folks know?
The 2022 Supreme Court Bruin decision was extremely important, and for a couple of reasons. The first was that it expanded the definition of Second Amendment rights, saying that average people now had a Second Amendment right to carry guns with them out in society for personal self-protection. The other big point from the Bruin decision was that the Supreme Court recast the basis for judging the constitutionality of modern gun laws, and the new standard is that they have to be grounded in some kind of historical tradition of regulating weapons. So lawyers, historians, and others have been scrambling since 2022 to examine old gun laws to try and see if there are analogs or similar laws that compare to modern firearms laws to try and justify and support the constitutionality of those modern laws. Now, as far as I'm concerned, the decision is a terrible decision, in part because it's ahistorical. For example, weapons carrying was widely regulated, restricted, and even barred in early America. In fact, from the 1600s to the start of the 20th century, every single state in the Union had restrictions against the concealed carrying of dangerous weapons, including but not limited to handguns or pistols. So to say that that is now protected under the Second Amendment based on a reading of history has history upside down. Moreover, this history standard is riddled with a vagueness, and it has opened the door to not only a flood of challenges of existing gun laws, laws that had been accepted without question before 2022, but it has also led to contrary conclusions where judges in one place will decide that historically analogous laws do support the constitutionality of a modern law, and other judges ruling the exact opposite.
Well, so there's no need to automatically exalt any resort to history, as I think you've said, when we know the time in which it was forged. But in the case of guns, if I can just draw you out, it doesn't even square, because as your work explains, Gun rights have always been paired with regulations. Talk a little more about that.
Many people think that in the old days, in the early decades and centuries of the country's founding, that everyone owned guns, that everybody was skilled in the use of guns, or at least adult white men, and that there were no gun restrictions or weapons restrictions to speak of until you get into the 20th century. And really, my research has found and demonstrated that the opposite is true. In many respects, firearms and other weapons were regulated more strictly in the country's first 300 years than in the last 30 years. From the 1600s, 1700s through the 1800s, states, colonies, and localities enacted literally thousands of weapons laws of every imaginable variety. I mean, you would be hard-pressed to come up with a gun regulation idea today that didn't exist 100, 150, 200 years ago. I mean, today in America's politicized environment, we view, or the antagonists in the gun debate view, a gain for one side as a loss for the other, what they call a zero-sum game. But that was not how gun rights and gun rules were thought of in most of our history. The two were perfectly compatible. Sure, you'd have clashes at times, but they did not pose the kind of polarizing political paralysis in terms of the gun issue that seems to exist today.
Maybe you've answered this, but as a researcher on the actual history of gun restrictions existing alongside the ability to own guns, what role do you see misinformation or misunderstanding playing in this country's evident inability to take meaningful steps? And how could media or journalists help in that regard?
Well, I think there is considerable misunderstanding about our own past, and the very idea that you might impose regulations on dangerous weapons doesn't mean that you're eliminating them entirely. It means that the government is doing the most important job that any government has, which is to protect the lives, health, and safety of its people. I mean, that's the single most important purpose of government. And of course, in a democratic society, you want to protect and guarantee individual rights and freedoms and the rest. But the idea that these two are mutually exclusive when it comes to gun laws is just a fallacy. And I think that news coverage, and I will say, I think news coverage has gotten better in terms of reporting the knowledge that people have gained regarding our own gun past, is to try and set aside the old kind of Wild West image of our frontier. Certainly it was an untamed piece of geography and period of time, but far more people, you know, if you think of the West of the 19th century, far more people died from disease, died from accidents, died from malnutrition than ever died from guns, frankly. And there were far, far, far fewer actual gunfights in the Wild West than is depicted or has been depicted in popular culture. So it's important to set aside the popular culture imagery of our historical past, whether it's the colonial era or the 19th century Western lands, and understand that not only were guns strictly regulated, as I mentioned, every state in the country had restrictions on the concealed carrying of weapons by the start of the 20th century, but those weapons not only included guns, but also included knives and clubs. Over 40 states, for example, had restrictions on the books regarding what were called Bowie knives, the sort of famous large-bladed knife named after the adventurer Jim Bowie. And the idea that knives of a class called fighting knives, the idea that over 40 states restricted those things, is one indication that public safety was indeed a top concern, and our forefathers and foremothers well recognized and understood that dangerous weapons were dangerous and that you were not depriving people of rights if you regulated them, restricted them, and imposed laws pertaining to, let's say, the time, place, and manner for carrying weapons or other kinds of restrictions.
Well, maybe it follows naturally, but finally, listeners may know of the recent statement from the U.S. Surgeon General declaring gun violence a public health crisis in recognition of the impacts of gun violence beyond those that are killed, to the wounded, to the families, to the communities, to mental and emotional health. That whole framing is very much at odds with the ownership conversation about individual rights. Can I ask you finally, do you see ways forward that engage all of this, or are we on maybe separate but complementary tracks in terms of concrete ways forward? What would you like to see?
I think there are a number of ways forward, and I would note at the outset that I think the public health and medical communities have contributed significantly and important knowledge and research about the consequences of guns and violence. Guns are uniquely destructive. They wreak more havoc on the body than any other interpersonal weapon. Any surgeon could tell you that. The people who staff emergency rooms could tell you that. It is a public health problem, crisis, and I think it's appropriate and beneficial that those communities have become involved in writing about, researching, and talking about the public health consequences, adverse consequences of prolific firearms. Beyond that, there are many public policy alternatives that demonstrably and measurably can reduce and have reduced in places where they existed gun harm, gun violence. And most people have heard of things like red flag laws or universal background checks or licensing schemes and other kinds of laws. Some states have those, some states don't. What is needed most, of course, is for the federal government to act more aggressively with respect to those or other gun policy areas. And that's been extremely difficult because of the very close competition between the Republicans and Democrats at the national level in Congress and in the presidency. But the states that have adopted stricter laws with respect to guns and gun violence have lower crime rates, lower suicide rates, lower homicide rates than states that have not adopted those sorts of measures. So we know they can make a difference. Yes, there are a great many guns in America. There are more guns than Americans, but most of them are owned by a minority of the country. That is, not every home in America has a gun, far from it. And the average gun owner wants to do the right thing and the responsible thing. And when you talk to gun owners and get past their instinctive suspicion of the phrase gun control or gun policy and talk about, well, what do you think should be the public policy? What you find is that most gun owners actually support most of the policy ideas to restrict and reduce gun harm that we are talking about in society today. So I think that all suggests some positive and constructive ways that the country can move forward.
All right, then. We've been speaking with Robert Spitzer of William & Mary School of Law and SUNY Cortland. The Gun Dilemma is out now from Oxford University Press, and the 9th edition of his book, The Politics of Gun Control, is out this year from Routledge. Thank you so much, Robert Spitzer, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
My pleasure.